A great joy to be with you this morning. We're meeting on Kaurna land, and so I want to acknowledge the traditional custodians, the Kaurna people here, stewards of our Creator God, and to pay my respects to their elders and any who might be present among us today. Over the last 3 years in Tanzania, I've been thinking a lot about what faith looks like. In Tanzania, everyone's talking about faith, and their particular focus, the thing that they want to talk about all the time, is how to persevere in faith, how to not give up, how are you going to keep going and not fall into despair. This so shapes how people think about faith that they're pretty much only ever interested in the looking forward with faith, not the looking back and assessing what's happened in the past. And really how they talk about it is that if you have faith, that if you accept a situation that you don't like, that is a sign of not having faith, of having given up or being resigned in some sense. So many of you would know that in the last couple of years, my identical twin sister got cancer. It was terminal, and then she died. And when we got the diagnosis that she had terminal cancer, I shared this with some of my friends. I call them the Mandazi ladies. Mandazi is like a delicious street food that you get in Tanzania. And the women sell it on the street side. And every day I would walk past the Mandazi ladies with Elliot when I was walking him to school. And so we got to know them and we got to chatting. We were talking about all kinds of things. And in Tanzania, you naturally talk about faith on the street. I told them about my twin's diagnosis, and that it was terminal, and the look on their faces was one of like extreme shock. And they weren't shocked because they were feeling for me because she had terminal cancer, though that was part of it. They were shocked that I would say she had terminal cancer, or that the doctors would say she had terminal cancer, because in Tanzania, once you say it, it's like you've made it a reality. And so they were saying, no, you've lost faith, keep praying that she will not die. And I'm saying, well, like, the doctors are pretty sure. But they considered that really sort of immoral, this idea that I would talk about this terminal diagnosis. And I kind of think that they've got a point in some ways, because when they pray like they actually expect God to do something. Whereas I pray like God's already made up his mind. Right, so I hedge my prayers with things like, if it's your will, please do such and such. Or sometimes I pray like fork in the road prayers, like, okay, I'm not sure which way God's going to go on this, so God, in the event that you choose this, here's my prayer. So in the event, if it is your will to heal her, please do so. If that's not your will, please help her to be patient in her suffering. Fork in the road kind of prayers, right? Because as if I don't really expect God to change anything on the basis of my prayers. So two very different ways of praying in Tanzania and in Australia. Here's what neither of us do. Neither of us turn up to Jesus and say, if you had been here, this wouldn't have happened. Tanzanians don't say it because they don't look back, because they're only looking forward all the time. And I don't say it because most of the time I'm too busy about saying the theologically correct thing, and God must know the right thing, so can't say anything about that. Except it's the refrain from our passage today, isn't it? Did you notice it came up twice? Both Mary and Martha say it. So I wonder how it sounds to you. Jesus, if you'd been here, this wouldn't have happened. Because it sounds a little bit theologically incorrect, doesn't it? On one hand, it sounds like you're saying God isn't present, like there's some part of his world that he just didn't show up for. And yet we know that God is with us and is everywhere and in control of his world. He's not absent, he hasn't abandoned his people. So on one hand, doesn't sound quite right. And then it's also got this sort of sense of accusation or something, like God is accountable to me, that I'm saying to him, listen, you know, I told you what was going to happen, because you didn't turn up, did you? It's your fault. Which, it kind of doesn't sound quite right theologically, because, well, he is, like, God, isn't he? And he does have a bigger plan for my good and his glory. So who am I to say that this wasn't a good idea? And yet neither time that this phrase is thrown at Jesus does he rebuke it. He doesn't turn around and say, no, no, I'm still with you, what do you mean? And he doesn't turn around and say, oh, no, no, you didn't realise I've got a bigger plan. Who are you to say that to me? Now, in part, maybe he doesn't rebuke it because he actually wasn't there. There is a truth to that. Like, they sent word and he didn't come. And had he come, maybe Lazarus would have been healed. So there's a sense in which the eventuality might have been different had Jesus actually got off his butt and gone the 2 miles. But what I want us to notice here is how Mary and Martha sort of throw this phrase at Jesus with abandon. I mean, Martha in particular, Jesus is coming out on the road and she's like going out to meet him. And this is how she greets him. She just spews her feelings of disappointment and betrayal and abandonment at Jesus. She's so honest, so vulnerable with her willingness to confront the truth and to bring it to Jesus. And he responds with compassion to that vulnerability. He doesn't rebuke Mary or Martha. He doesn't have a doctrinal conversation with them. He doesn't justify his actions. He just asks to be taken to Lazarus. And then he gets there and he is gutted by the grief that he sees. While we might be uncomfortable with this level of accusation against God, Martha isn't. And it turns out, neither is Jesus. Because they're first century Jews. Martha has grown up steeped in the Psalms, including the Psalms of Lament. She knows that these are Psalms of faith. And she knows that the life of faith is one of being honest and vulnerable with God. And here we see Jesus, God in flesh. We see how God responds to the hurting person. We see that he responds not with anger, not with indignation, but with compassion. If we are hesitant to speak to God like this, perhaps it's because we don't know him as well as we think we do. He's not sitting there ready to pounce on our theology. He is the gracious and compassionate one who binds up the brokenhearted. This brings us to the second part of Martha's little speech here, where she says, I know even now God will give you whatever you ask. Now, this might sound like a statement of great faith, of believing that Jesus can raise the dead. But if we read a little further, I think we'll see that's not actually what's going on here. I want you to imagine this scenario. So imagine you're a child and you go to an adult and you say to them, I know that even now you can grant me an ice cream. And the adult says, you will have an ice cream. And the child's response is, wahoo, ice cream! Or maybe, if they're a particularly discerning child, like right now, you mean, just checking in. That's not how it happens between Martha and Jesus. See, Jesus says to her, your brother will rise again. And she doesn't say, oh good, let's go to his tomb because it's going to happen right now. She doesn't even say, oh yeah, like today, you mean today. She says the equivalent of, yeah, I know he's going to rise eventually. This is the equivalent of you saying to a child, you will have an ice cream, and then responding, yeah, I know, Christmas time. This is not the response of a person who thinks they've just had their request granted. Jesus says her brother will rise, and she figures that he's talking about some like way future day, because that's her expectation. She's not thinking it's going to happen right now. I think basically what she's doing is saying the theologically correct thing, right? She comes to Jesus, she spews her feelings at him, and then she says the thing that you have to say. You know, your will be done. I know you can do it. I don't think she actually expects it to happen. And it's not that she doesn't believe in Jesus, of course. She confesses who he is. She makes this very strong statement of faith in verse 27. But the life of faith is often saying things that we only believe a little bit until we do believe them, even if we only believe them a little bit. I think that's what Martha's doing. Even now, I know that you can. I think she probably feels maybe a bit insincere saying that, or like it's empty words. But these two statements taken together, I think, give us a picture of the life of faith. The first one is expressing yourself to God. If only you had been here. And the second is affirming who he is, even if you only believe it a little bit. Even now I know. This is the life of faith. It's not grasping as a sure something that we have no guarantee of, but it is also refusing despair. It is walking in fear and disappointment and being honest about that, and yet still being willing somehow to trust God. Over the last 3 years, we've seen God answer our prayers, often very big prayers that, quite frankly, we didn't expect him to answer. We just prayed them because you meant to pray. So here's an example. I said earlier about Arthur taking over as national director. Before that, quite some time before that, when we just arrived at in Dar es Salaam, the situation that we walked into was that there were some issues with the top level of leadership in TAFES. There was a really wonderful Christian man who is the national director, very godly guy, sacrificially living in a very substandard kind of situation with his family, his wife and his two young kids, so that he could serve with TAFES. And he was great, and he'd stepped up to the role because no one else was gonna take it. But he had some issues with leadership and management skills, and the staff were pretty stressed, and the board had some issues with them, and there was a fair bit of stress in the organisation. The staff were not getting paid because there was a funding crisis. So as you can imagine, there was not a lot of ministry getting done. And it was coming up to the end of this guy's contract. And the question was, what was going to happen? What would happen at the top level of leadership of TAFES? Now, the staff were asked for feedback, but in Tanzania, for very good reasons, you pretty much only say positive things about people, so you wouldn't actually say what the issues were. We were asked as well. We were as honest as we felt we could be, but I mean, it wasn't our job to start, you know, moving the pieces around and trying to make things happen. So sort of what happened was that the board was a little bit sort of in the dark about the reality of what was happening, and we had this question of how can anything change if, you know, the information's not out there that needs to be out there or whatever. And we had this question about, even if the board knew, would they have the courage to change things up? Would they have the social finesse to do it in a way that would still save face for him, because he'd been a wonderful, you know, godly servant? And like I say, this was not our job to take care of, and you got to be, you know, we wanted to be careful that we weren't sticking our oar in where it was not wanted or needed. And so we prayed, because that was our option. God, give TAFES a great national director. And to tell you the truth, we thought it was a long shot. And we kept praying it, thinking, like, we're going to pray this, but we didn't really expect God to do it. And then I guess the question back in my head was, how are we going to view this prayer later on when God doesn't answer it? but the board did remove that national director, and they did it in a way that preserved his honour and looked after his family. And so then the question was, well, who's the next national director going to be? And there was, it took a little bit of time for that to get sorted out. There was a national director who came in, she quit not long later, then Arthur had to come in, and we're thinking, surely it's not God's answer to prayer that Arthur would become the national director. Then God answered our prayers. We've got this new national director with, like, great leadership skills, great management skills, knows business stuff, so knows how to get the funding side of TAFES going. He's got this ministry mindset. His name's Musa. And we are astonished that God answered our prayer, and, like, way better than we could have ever hoped he actually would. And like I say, we weren't actually praying that we were expecting that God would answer it. I pretty much work on the assumption that God doesn't give me what I want. A little bit like a parent giving their kids chores and vegetables, because it makes them grow, but it's unpleasant. But I figure that, you know, that Jesus is trying to shape me into the likeness of himself. His job is not to give me a smooth run. He's not Santa. He's not a vending machine. He's not at my beck and call. He's God. And he knows best. And so when I pray, that's part of the reason that I pray like I do, right? Because I'm thinking, well, you know best, God, so, you know, what have I got to say? Except this time, God came through for us. And so, except it's all very well to say, oh, well, God just gives me the things that are good for me. He's not a vending machine or whatever, when God does come through for you, right? But that's like, well, how convenient that this time God's will aligned with what I wanted. What happens when it doesn't? Like, it's all very convenient for Martha, isn't it? Her brother does get raised in the end. It's all very well convenient for me to get up and tell you about our hunt for the national director and how God gave us, you know, exactly what we wanted. It was more than we could have imagined. I can say we felt in the dark at the time. We couldn't see what was coming. We didn't know if God was going to answer our prayers. But on this side of it, you know, it's all looking pretty rosy. So what happens when that doesn't happen? What happens when it doesn't end the way you want it to? Well, during this period when God was wonderfully answering our prayers for Tafes, my twin sister died of cancer. There were many people who were praying for her and praying for her healing. And like Martha, we know that she was secure in Christ, that she'll be raised on the last day, but she wasn't healed. Why did God answer our prayers for Tafes and not our prayers for Steph? Was it part of some grand plan that he knew better? As Mary and Martha say to Jesus, well, he could have come earlier. And if he'd come when he'd been called, Lazarus would have been healed. But he delays. And he delays for a purpose. He actually wants Lazarus to be dead by the time he gets there. And not just a little bit dead, like good and dead, like starting to smell dead. It's quite gruesome in a lot of ways, isn't it? Because Jesus actually has another agenda. In verse 4, he says, the point of the sickness is for God's Son to be glorified. He could have avoided this whole thing, but he doesn't want to. He's purposely delaying. He's purposely not going to Bethany. He's purposely letting Lazarus die, intentionally putting these sisters through heart-rending grief. Why? Oh, so he can do a big resurrection miracle instead of just your run-of-the-mill healing miracle. Does it seem a little bit heartless? It's like breaking an arm so you can mend it, and then everyone goes, oh, wow, Jesus, you're such a good doctor. What about the person whose arm was broken? What about the sisters who are in mourning for their brother? Is their sorrow and pain justified because in the end Lazarus was raised? I think a deeper look at this passage flips that idea on its head and shows us a Jesus of deep compassion. Much is made of verse 35, Jesus wept as a sign that he loved Lazarus. But in verse 33, Jesus has another emotional reaction. He sees Mary and the other mourners and he is deeply moved in spirit and troubled. He's moved by their suffering. When Jesus weeps, he doesn't weep only for his own loss, but out of empathy for the loss that others are experiencing. Jesus is not unfeeling towards our pain or uninterested in it. He weeps with us. It's not only Lazarus who Jesus loved. It's Mary and Martha and you. But Jesus isn't only empathising. Mary and Martha are not the only ones being hurt in this situation. Actually, it's incredibly dangerous for Jesus. Do you remember that bit at the start of the passage where he's talking with the disciples about going to Bethany? And they're like, Jesus, we don't think it's a good idea. Because remember the last time you were there, you were stoned? That's the ancient world equivalent of an assassination attempt, right? It is serious. It is seriously dangerous for Jesus. And when eventually Jesus says, I'm going, remember what Thomas says? Now, Thomas, he's got a bit of a flair for the dramatic, right? But he's like, fine, we'll go with you so we can die with you, Jesus. But it's a real possibility, right? They know what they're walking into here. And we know that it's a real possibility because we didn't read it, but immediately after this passage, the Sanhedrin and the chief priests get together and they're like, right, so Jesus is doing really big public miracles, lots of people getting on his side, he's way too politically dangerous, so let's get together, we've got to work out how to kill him now. So we have, the passage starts with them being like, okay, it might be a bit dangerous to go in there, Jesus. Jesus does his big miracle, and then the Sanhedrin like, yeah, we definitely want to kill that guy. So, obviously it is a dangerous situation, right? And immediately after this, the plotting gets so bad that Jesus has to go into hiding in a remote village. So it's obviously a dangerous situation. And it's this resurrection of Lazarus, which initiates the plot to kill Jesus. And that's part of the reason it's so public. It's part of the reason it's so amazing. Because this is Jesus' long game. At one level, okay, yes, he delays so that he can do a resurrection instead of just your run-of-the-mill healing. And yes, he does that so that he can reveal that he's the resurrection and the life and God can be glorified. But why does he do that? Because there's another layer of reasoning behind that. See, Jesus has come to earth for a purpose. His purpose is to die and to be raised to the Father's side. So if we follow the logic of this story, he raises Lazarus to show his glory, which makes the religious authorities mad at him, so they start plotting to get him to the cross, where he will absorb the world's mourning and pain and sin and brokenness into himself. And he will rise again to bring the first fruits of a new world where all those things will no longer exist. Jesus isn't just using Mary and Martha's pain to get the glory he so richly deserves. He is knowingly endangering his life in order to bring them a world where they will never experience pain at all. Yes, there is a bigger plan here, but it's a bigger plan of love for Mary, for Martha, for Lazarus, for my twin sister, and for you. Jesus doesn't move us around on like pieces on a chessboard. He grieves with us and he offers us himself. The life of faith is one of acknowledging the disconnect that we feel here, that perhaps God is not for us after all. It's an act of faith to acknowledge it and to say it. And the life of faith is also saying the things we don't believe until we do believe them, even if we only believe them a little bit. Things like, the Father loves us. The Spirit is at work among us. Jesus holds us in his love. God's presence will be with us. The world will be made new. This is what equips us to put one foot in front of the other. It's what equips us to continue with a fragile work in Tanzania. It's what keeps us clinging to him in the darkness. And he weeps with us there in that darkness. This is a God who suffers with us and for us because he also wants a new world and is setting about bringing that to be. We offer ourselves to him haltingly because he offered himself to us fully. We have nothing to fear from him, so we are freed to come to him. In another part of John, Peter says to Jesus, "Where else have we to go? You have the words of eternal life." But this one who we have no other choice to go to, treats us gently. Jesus says, "Come to me, you who are weary, and I will give you rest. Come to me, throw your pain at me, I will bear it, and I will give you rest. I have borne all that is wrong with the world in order to make a new one." It's coming. It's here. So come to me. Let's pray. Dear Jesus, in words we read in John from another of your followers, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Amen.